Hello, strong, feisty women. Some of you may recognize my voice. I'm Celine Yeager, host of the Hit Play Not Pause podcast. Throughout my career as a professional health and fitness writer and now a podcaster, I hear countless questions from women who are trying to understand how their ever-changing hormones impact their sports performance. So we decided to serve up some answers in a brand new series called Hormonal that we will be releasing on the Feisty Women's Performance Podcast feed. Throughout this four-part series, reproductive endocrinologist Dr. Carla DiGirolamo and I will be tackling topics like periods, the pill, pregnancy, and conditions like PCOS, all from the perspective of sports performance. If you aren't already, follow the Feisty Women's Performance Podcast and stay tuned for our first episode releasing on April 15th. Also, have questions you want answered? Send us a voice note at speakpipe.com/hormonal and we'll get it answered on the show.
Hey, feisty friends, welcome to the Feisty Women's Performance Podcast, where each week we deliver trusted information for women who want to get the best from their bodies throughout their lives. Learn to feel and perform your best through our four pillars of performance: physiology, nutrition, mental health, and culture. I'm your host, Sarah Gross, and this is a Feisty Media production. Hi, feisty strong women. Welcome to episode 12 of the Feisty Women's Performance Podcast. I think it's episode 12, so I think we're kind of done with season one. I'm going to take a little break for the next couple weeks to regroup and see what kind of awesomeness we can bring to episodes 13 to 24. But I was just looking back actually on some of the episodes we've done. I'm literally scrolling through my phone right now, starting with that panel, you know, about how every woman deserves performance. We've talked about, if you haven't listened to them, we've talked about diet culture with Taylor Tracy and her amazing keynote, Christy Moan talking about advocacy and race directing, Kristen Arnold and that episode about fueling our bodies, Monica Garrison and changing cycling culture, Dr. Carla D and the hormones and how we're not broken. I love that. Lil Wilcox, always inspiring, and the storytelling genius. Amelia Boone, learning to live life to the fullest. We had Celine's keynote from the Feisty Women's Performance Summit about pushing back and speaking out and how we can create community and welcome people in. Then we have, oh my gosh, we had Emily and Megan from Faster, the research group from out of Stanford, talking about female performance. Last week, we had Josephine Holmberg, who honestly, like, I knew nothing about bikini competitions before chatting with her. So interesting. And now this week, we have the extremely smart and well-spoken Holly Samuel from Fit Cookie Nutrition. I was on her podcast a little while back, and as we were talking, I thought, you know what? I'd really love to have you on my podcast. So she's a registered dietitian and a personal trainer. She works with a lot of runners and in the endurance space with nutrition. She also, like, we dove into a lot of really interesting areas this week, her background as an equestrian athlete, and like how we shift our thinking from like that kind of restrictive diet culture to more like how we understand the value of food and what food will do for us, and then how we teach our kids to do that too. I also asked Holly about her own entrepreneurship because she's built quite a big brand with Fit Cookie Nutrition during the pandemic as well. So I was interested in how she manages her time and keeps on top of all the reels and podcasting and all the things, you know, that entrepreneurs do nowadays. So that was interesting too. And then also she gives me some advice about managing stress through food too, which I hadn't heard before. So I do hope you will all enjoy this conversation as much as I did. I also want to give a shout out to our sponsors. We do have Inside Tracker as a sponsor, and they, I know I've mentioned before, but they come and do a blood draw and will tell you, you know, what's going on with your blood and how you can eat and train to be healthier. It's a really interesting inside view of our physiology. And then also, honestly, the CBD intimacy oil, yum. I think everyone should try it. But enough about that. on with the show.
Hi, Holly. Welcome to the podcast.
Hey, how's it going? I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, me too. Me too. We recorded, how long ago was that on your podcast? About a month ago?
I think so. Yeah. Time flies. I felt like it was still more wintery out. So it was probably a month ago.
Yeah. That's why I said a month, not because it feels like a month, but because of that, like the passage of time is a bit blurry still.
Yeah, seriously.
But yeah, we had such a fun conversation that I thought, oh, I should have you over here on the Women's Performance Podcast. So good to see you. Okay. I want to start first asking you about your own athletic background. I know that you rode horses as a kid. Were you a sporty child?
Yeah. So, identifying myself as a sporty child, I know we talked about like self-identification on my episode with you too. Like, I don't know, I wouldn't have identified myself as like a sporty kid, mm-hmm. but at the same time, I did kind of start to identify, I think, more as an athlete, the more serious I got at the like equestrian sport with horses. Mm-hmm. But like, I played soccer, like probably until I was maybe like 8 or 9, probably until the time I got my first pony. And then, you know, I was always the soccer kid on the field who was like, I hate confrontation. Like if I have the ball, everyone's running at me. Definitely didn't like that. Got to get rid of the ball and like, would just give it up. So thinking of myself as like a team sport, gym sporty kid was definitely not something I necessarily would have said, but yeah, I grew up riding horses and that was definitely something I was super good at. I competed through high school and college and at a national level and, kind of started to do it like semi-professionally after college. And then kind of my career took over. I burned out from the sport a little bit, which is a shame. But then I started running. So that's kind of how I fell into the endurance world, was probably partway through college. But until then, all like my sportiness was pretty much always at the barn.
Right. And what kind of equestrian sports did you do?
Yeah, I did mostly hunter jumpers. I played with eventing a little bit in college. My aunt had a really awesome like event horse for cross country and stuff, but mostly hunter jumpers.
Huh. And do you still ever ride horses?
I haven't in a while. I'll get on like my aunt's horse. She lives right down the street from me every once in a while, but I really don't do it much anymore, which is like not something I ever pictured for myself. And it's kind of weird to say, it's like a picture of a horse hanging in my office. And my husband's always like, maybe that'll be the only horse we ever get. So I'm like, I don't know. We'll see if I get back into it in the future, but I always love the animals.
Yeah. And so you said you were a bit burnt out and you started running. Tell us about that time period. Like what caused the burnout and how did you find running?
Yeah. Let me think about the timeline. So I probably started to get a little bit burnt out at the end of college and afterwards. I was riding like probably 8 or 9 horses a day for a lot of the time, which was like my whole day, basically. And I loved it. It was great. I got to ride a lot of cool horses that other people owned. And I was basically exercising and training them for these people. And I honestly got a little bit burnt out of like that schedule, not being able to really step away from that schedule, getting frustrated that I didn't have like my own horse because they're very expensive animals to kind of keep around and stay healthy. They're like the biggest, most fragile beasts that exist. And they require a lot of work and I know how much work it takes. And I wasn't sure I wanted to necessarily like sell my soul to the barn life. And some of the politics honestly got kind of tough too. I think I burnt out a lot of the politics of the horse world, but I kind of fell out of it, fell into my post-grad career, kind of becoming a dietitian, which I know we'll talk about, mm-hmm. which really left me no time, you know, to do both. So that's kind of around the time I started to take up running in college, around the times of the Boston Marathon bombings. Mm-hmm. I just found that like crazy that, you know, I kind of read about the bombings and then what a marathon was and how long it was. And I knew people running marathons at the time and kind of just fell into it for stress relief. And then it totally took over. Like once I kind of stopped the equestrian sport.
Well, that's really interesting. So you only just found out like really about the marathon at that time, because that feels really recent history to me.
I mean, I know.
I'm like, here I am. here you are. Yeah. Helping tons of runners and everything. I have one more question about the equestrian thing, because I know that like equestrian's generally considered one of the more egalitarian sports in terms of gender. Even though, like, I think you mentioned there in terms of socioeconomic access, there's some challenges. But did you find that to be the case? Like, did you find as a girl doing equestrian, did you feel really well supported?
That's a really interesting perspective. I'll totally like own my privilege too. Like, I was an only child. My parents were kind of able to put me in really good, you know, situations at really nice barns. I was able to have a horse. I did work off a lot of my board, and I did kind of ride other people's horses for them and make some compromises there. But super lucky as a kid to be able to have that. And it is mostly female dominated sport. Mm-hmm. And my instructor and my trainer growing up was probably one of the only like male riders that I knew. He was awesome. I was really, really, really fortunate. I actually met my husband at that barn too. His parents owned it. Mm-hmm. And that's how I met my husband. But our trainer, you know, he is just really safe, like really prioritized like safety and health. And, you know, he was like the first one to point out to me, hey, like you're, you know, about to pass out every time we go to a show. So like, you need to drink more water and like take electrolytes, and maybe you need to eat more, and maybe you need to work on certain things. So I was really lucky, because in my other experiences, you know, kind of after the fact, like that just totally wasn't the case. You know, there's a lot of females in the sport. There's also a lot of eating disorders in the sport. How the person looks on the horse is part of the judgment process in competitions. Oh.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, not every type of discipline, but for probably the most elite of the elite, like dressage and show jumping, especially equitation, it has to do a lot with how you look in the ring on the horse. So that's definitely a theme that's super prevalent in that sport that I was very lucky that I didn't really have to experience, because I was in such a good environment growing up, which I learned later in my life that it is very much not the norm.
Right.
There's a lot of, you know, kind of shady things in the horse world. There's a lot of eating disorders and a lot of bad coaching, kind of like there is in the running world, to be honest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's so interesting. I one time had a minor disagreement with someone from the equestrian world who was trying to argue that equestrians like totally gender equal, et cetera, et cetera. I'm like, I understand that. I love that the women can compete against the men and all of those pieces fall into place.
Right.
But there's no, you can't separate a sport from our culture. Like just exactly what you're talking about, like feeling those body image pressures in any sport, I think is like, it's sort of, I'm not going to say like it has to be, because I obviously we want to get to a world where it isn't the case, but like really you can't separate those things out. Right.
Yeah. And to even like highlight my trainer, his name's Kevin McQueen, Millstone Farm in New Jersey. If anyone's listening, you should go there. It's a great place. But him and his wife, Jackie, kind of run their business now. And even like that partnership is just very unique. Like I haven't really seen that anywhere else in the horse world where that's successful and it works really well for their, you know, for their relationship. But yeah, it's totally true. Like I think we had maybe two other male riders at the barn of like, you know, 30 horses. So it is very much female dominated. And with that definitely comes like an image, you know, and I think that's really interesting to dive into.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So at this point you're transitioning, you're becoming a runner and you've decided to become a dietitian, right? What kind of led to that interest in food and dietetics and all those things?
Yeah. So I went to college at the University of New Hampshire. My freshman year, I entered pre-med. So I always kind of knew I was good at science. I liked the anatomy and biology classes I took in high school and kind of knew I wanted to do something with that, maybe in the healthcare field. I didn't really know what though. And I was really lucky. And I always shout out UNH for this. They make a lot of their freshmen who have declared a major take like a one credit, like, this is about your major. This is what the path looks like. This is what you can do with this major. Like, this is what you have to do maybe post-grad, if that's something that you have to do in order to achieve these careers. And I learned very quickly through taking that class that I absolutely did not want to be a doctor. and that definitely wasn't what I thought it was going to be.
Right.
And really hated that class, but looking back, I'm like, oh, that was a really good class. But my advisor at the time, she was the anatomy and physiology professor, and she also happened to be an advisor in the nutrition program. And I had a lot of big, soul searching type talks with her. And she was like, I think what you're describing, wanting to do from health from a holistic standpoint and helping people understand how to, maybe prevent, diseases, or just focusing on helping people from a more holistic standpoint instead of treating conditions with medications, and surgery and that kind of thing. She's like, I think you might be actually better off being a dietitian. That's what this is called. This is how you do it. And actually the majors, the pre-med major and the dietetics major are very similar. There's a few differences that basically involve me taking nutrition specific biochemistry versus just regular biochemistry, or taking additional classes in food science or psychology or counseling and that kind of thing. So it's pretty easy to switch my major into dietetics because it was kind of the same, but with a different focus. So I was lucky to have kind of her guidance there, because I really didn't know really what a dietitian was and what their role was in the healthcare system and beyond until I got into school and she told me about it. But it was totally selfish too. I definitely wanted, to learn. I think a lot of dietitians say this about themselves. I wanted to learn about nutrition to support my own benefit too. I had started to become a bit more active in the fitness world at the time. And I'd be lying too if I said there wasn't a little bit of disorder there, where I wanted to kind of use it to control the way that I looked and was perceived to the world. So that's kind of what started my interest in nutrition.
Yeah. Interesting. So would you ever say that you got to the point of having an eating disorder, or were you just kind of, because I asked this question for myself too, so I can answer it too, but, or was it just kind of some feeling the pressures and some disordered type thinking?
I think when I got to college, and my parents can say this about me too, I definitely was a very anxious perfectionist. It was the perfect storm kind of situation through high school. I was top of my class, and I got to college and it was all different, and I'm an only child and I was away from home, and I was definitely super anxious, and I didn't have that barn outlet as much anymore. So my schedule looked different. And I think the anxiety component is what kind of caused some of the disordered eating to happen. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say that I had I definitely didn't have a diagnosed eating disorder. I know a lot of them go undiagnosed though, now that I'm in practice, but I would say I had disordered eating tendencies and compulsive exercise tendencies for sure. And I think a lot of it had to do more rooted with anxiety. And that was definitely triggered by that transition. But once I kind of, honestly, that's kind of when running came into my life. It first came into my life as a way to manage stress and maybe also control the way that I looked. Mm-hmm. And then once I got into it, it just turned into so much more than that. And was definitely a pivotal moment in that side of me.
Yeah, it sounds like, from what you're describing, it sounds like you just learn a ton of stuff in a short time. There's some people who really go through that whole journey you just described, but in decades, right? But what I'm hearing you say is that you recognize disordered patterns in yourself and were able to shift and use running for stress relief. And I think that's great. What led you to, because you have a master's also, right, in health education?
I do. And
with an eating disorder focus, is that where that kind of that interest came from?
Actually, it came a little bit later. It was interesting too. I had a friend my freshman year who actually ended up having to pause her college career because she had to go into eating disorder treatment. And that definitely, I think, was something I saw while I was learning all the things that I was I don't want that to happen to me. I see how that could happen so easily with the perfect storm, and kind of what the prognosis is of that is really, it's just a really challenging road. So, I think I was definitely the type of person where I think I identified myself as an athlete pretty quickly. And that really helped me be I don't have time for this restriction nonsense. I want to run faster. So how do I do that? Oh, I got to feel my body. Okay. I'll do that. So it was definitely an ever-growing process, but once I did become a dietitian and I was counseling people in a one-on-one setting, I learned pretty quickly that a lot of people don't have a good relationship with food. In fact, I rarely met people who did have a good relationship with food. So that's kind of what sparked my wanting to learn more about how to help people with that, because In traditional like dietetics training, it's there's so much school and there's so much science background. We have to learn so much about like clinical settings and food service settings and community settings that the eating disorder chapter is literally like non-existent, basically. So I kind of had to seek out more information on that, which I figured out probably 3 years into my career.
Yeah, it's just, this is fascinating. I think that you're right that there's so many people who have this same, who have that same story where it's like not quite, there's not a lot of clinically diagnosed eating disorder, but like that's certainly my story in high school. I was like having a, we had moved to the Middle East. And, you know, I always relate when people say, oh, eating disorders are often about controlling your environment, you know, because I think I kind of like started to restrict my food as a way to control my environment and control what I looked like, you know, and then like there's an there's a missing education piece. And this is what I want to ask you what you think about it. But like, you know, I didn't know, we didn't learn anything in school about food. And then the first things that I was learning were things that I was finding on the internet about, I guess it was pre-internet. So, but they must've been magazines. That's how old I am. Yeah. They must've been magazines. Yeah. Like learning about
terrible.
Yeah. Like diet culture. So like I'm looking at like, before I even understand how like nutrients are sustaining my body, right? I'm learning about like how to control calories so that I can look a certain way or have a less body fat percentage or whatever. Like that just seems crazy to me. So like, how do you think we can change that culture for our kids?
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I think, that was a big thing. I was trying to reflect on this the other day with someone, like what we learn in like health class, you know, like in elementary, middle and high school, you know, and I remember learning things like, you know, my plate or the food pyramid and eat more vegetables. And again, like a lot of it, I think is taught, it depends on the teacher, but it's also just the curriculum sent from like, you know, the USDA or the government. It's kind of taught even from more of a restrictive lens these days, especially because, you know, we always talk about, oh, like America has like an obesity problem. It's the obesity epidemic, I've even heard it called. So I think like a lot of what we see from, you know, even like the medical field can be through a very restrictive, not helpful lens. And then what we see through like the media and the fitness magazines and the celebrity magazines and like those types of things are all about appearance. So we kind of seem to have this value as a culture on like thinness and of course whiteness and like a certain appearance. So anything that challenges that is automatically like wrong. And I mean, even the dietetics field, kind of similar to the horse field, it's white and it's female. Like it's predominantly white and it's predominantly female. It's definitely, you know, a very like, it's a privilege to be able to go through the schooling to acquire these credentials, and it's not totally accessible for everyone. So that does limit who is able to become, you know, a dietitian, even though it shouldn't be the case. So that we also have the same value represented in the people who are dietitians. They're white, they're female, and they're thin. Like I'll be the first to acknowledge that. It's exactly what I am. So it's definitely interesting to observe that. And I think that's something that I noticed in a lot of, you know, healthcare settings was, well, just because someone is not, you know, white or thin or whatever, it doesn't mean that they can't have a bad relationship with food. You know, I had that experience, but it doesn't mean that you have to look like me to have that experience, right? Like, in fact, they probably maybe have more of trouble with it because they don't, you know, represent that thin ideal. So kind of a soapbox topic, but yeah, I mean, I think in terms of teaching our kids better, I think the more we can just put all foods on a level playing field, be able to describe the nutritional value or just the value that they provide to us, not the moral value, but like, hey, this food is going to make your eyes stronger, or, you know, this food tastes really good and, you know, it might make you feel good inside, or, you know, this food might make your bones stronger. And the more we can just kind of educate about what each food can do for us and that it doesn't have to have such like an emotionally charged moral value over what we're going to look like if we eat that food. You know, I think that can be a really good step in the right direction. So it's just not taught through like this restrictive lens.
So interesting. Okay. So now, like in your work as a dietitian now, what do you see as some of the most like common challenges for that, for active women too, or for the runners that you work with and other athletes?
I think what we just talked about, one thing that's super challenging that I see often is that like nutrition for the general public, especially through, like I just told you, like the restrictive lens in the medical field, or even like just the kind of diet culture based fitness celebrity, you know, appearance based field, mm-hmm. it just doesn't apply. It doesn't apply to you if you are doing like physical activity, or if you're identifying yourself as an athlete, meaning you're going to exercise on purpose to, you know, improve your skills in some way, mm-hmm. no matter what level you are. It's just a lot of general nutrition recommendations out there. They may not apply to you. So when you then learn about like sports nutrition recommendations, it can become super confusing for people. Mm-hmm. Like right now, whether it's right or wrong, you know, in the media, carbohydrates are the devil. They're terrible. You know, they're the root of all evil. But in the sports nutrition world, they're like the foundation of everything that we teach. So, mm-hmm. You know, it's a lot of contradicting things like that, that I think are challenging, including again, like your energy being restricted, low calorie, this, you know, diet, not eating enough, going to bed hungry, a lot of those messaging in kind of a diet cultural lens, like it's just going to lead to injury, hormone imbalance, and so many other problems as an athlete. As a healthy person too, but especially as an athlete.
Yeah, it's certainly when I was an elite athlete, it was in the middle of like the carbs, like the massive carbs for athletes. Like I was even told by, and to some extent I still do this, so it's not necessarily all bad or wrong, but like I was told by my nutritionist at the time to have like to have candy like during and after exercise. I still use that one. So, but like, same. And I started to eat way more carbohydrates than I naturally tended to at that time. And I started to get blood sugar problems, like when my blood sugar would just drop off the planet, like that I had never had problems like that before. So like clearly whatever I was craving, you know, was like kind of working, like that I needed a little bit more fats and protein, right? Then it was just like, it's such an interesting time. And now it's like shift. Now it's gone like the other way. You see athletes trying to cut carbs completely out, like you said, like, and it's like, that doesn't work either, because we're all just walking around like zombies and like, why are we so tired? So that didn't work. Yeah. So it's like, there is a lot of misinformation out there. I wanted to ask you, like, what are some things that you wish like every sort of woman who now, like you said, like who identifies an athlete or who exercises on purpose would know about nutrition? Like what are a couple practical tips that you would give anyone?
Yeah. So I think the biggest things are, as an active woman, like you need to eat within an hour of waking up. You need to probably every 2 to 4 hours after that. And you definitely need to eat all of the macronutrients. They're all important. They do different things for us. There's not one that's like better than the other. They do different things for us. So those include carbohydrates, which, you know, turn into glucose and we eat them. And that's our brain and muscles' main fuel source. Also protein, which turns into amino acids when we eat them. And that helps build our muscle tissue. And it helps us feel full because it digests really slowly. And fats, which also digest really slowly. So they help us feel full. They're involved in building our hormones up. And they can also be an energy source, but they're not the most efficient energy source compared to carbohydrates when it comes down to how they're broken down in these fancy biochemistry situations that I won't get into. But those would probably be the biggest things. Like you need to feel your body often throughout the day. You need to do it in a way that is intuitive, but there's also probably going to be some ways where it does feel a little bit forced because as you know, sport can like blunt our appetite if we're really stressed, you know, and we are doing things that are not intuitive, like running a marathon. That's not intuitive at all. no one's just like, gee, I think I'll go run 26.2 miles today on the dot. So some of it's not going to be intuitive and it will feel a little forced, but that's okay. You know, just kind of give yourself some grace.
Great. That's great advice. Oh, I love that eating throughout the day. Like even right now, I'm like, oh yeah, eat within an hour of waking up. You know, like I'm still sitting there with my coffee, like hard at work at my computer, sometimes 2 or 3 hours after I wake up. And then my first symptom is like, I'm not thinking right. You know? So that's definitely good advice, at least for me anyway. Okay. So you're also like a serial entrepreneur, it looks like here. You know, you obviously run your business where you have coaching clients and nutrition clients, but you also have Miss Bakes-A-Lot cookie catering. Is that, are you still doing that?
I don't think it's dead. I definitely haven't like killed the LLC, but yeah, that was probably my first. I didn't even mention that. That was my first business in college. I make a mean chocolate chip cookie, basically, of my talents. And I used to have like a small catering business in college. My cousin named it. I used to live across the street, and he'd call me Miss Bakes a Lot across the street. So that's kind of where Miss Bakes a Lot came from. And when I knew I wanted to start, you know, my kind of private practice for nutrition counseling, I knew I wanted to work with, you know, athletes. And I was like, I don't know, I kind of want to keep like the cookie in there somewhere. So that's where Fit Cookie Nutrition came out of.
Oh, I love it. I love it. And so how did you sell the cookies? I'm just so curious about this.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of my friends kind of knew, like, I would just, I don't know if there were like parties, whether it was like a typical college party or like a family gathering or a friend's birthday party, like I showed up with cookies. Like that's just, Holly's going to bring cookies. And baking like during high school and college was something that I did also to relieve stress. Like I really still enjoy it quite a bit. So that's kind of where that came from. And I had a lot of time. I had a lot of stress to manage. So I had a lot of time to perfect my cookie recipe with all the baking that I did. And people were like, you could sell these, like, you know, in college, like if people just want some cookies in the middle of the night, like you could probably sell these. So I just started doing it like through word of mouth, and it was super small and just on the side, but it was a ton of fun.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Yeah. And I even like, you know, just looking through your website today, like I can see that you've really built a good, like robust business. Like, you know, you do the podcast, you do a great job of reels on Instagram. I see them all now, you know, you're obviously working with clients, and then you have some digital products on there. Like how did you basically decide to go for it and do that? And then also, like, I think a lot of people might feel, who want to do something like building your own business or brand, might feel overwhelmed by that, because it's like, oh, I have to create all this content. Like, how am I going to make time for that? So what would you tell those people?
Oh my gosh. Yeah, it's definitely a lot. And I was definitely overwhelmed when I started, which is probably why it took me a little bit to start. But yeah, I mean, I think in terms of the timeline, I always kind of knew, like, what, even when I learned what a dietitian was and what they could do, I was like, oh, I bet like working for myself, like private practice, that seems interesting to me. I've always been pretty independent that way. And super, very much like a workaholic. So the self-motivation to do work is not a problem for me. If anything, it's to a fault sometimes, but, yeah, essentially. So like, you know, kind of diving into entrepreneurship and like not having financial stability and whatnot, that was definitely scary. And I was kind of hemming and hawing over like when would be a good time to do that. And I was lucky that my husband at the time, you know, when I kind of started to think about it in 2019, like he had a stable job, and me at the time, I had a stable job that I honestly like loved. And I probably wasn't going to leave it unless I got like a push, because I loved who I worked with. I kind of, you know, I liked enough what I did and the setting that I was in. And I was good at it. So that always feels good, just to have the confidence to be able to go to work and, you know, not be super overwhelmed all the time. But we actually made the decision, my husband and I, to move to North Carolina from New Hampshire in 2020. We just wanted to do something different. His job had an office there, so we were going to do that. We were going to sell our house, and I was going to start my business when we did that, because it kind of naturally made sense. I figured I could always get a job if I needed to, you know, when I was there, but that I would start my business. And we moved in March of 2020. And of course, the pandemic started. So telehealth, you know, definitely was a good thing. I was always planning to go virtual with my business, so that worked out well for me. And, you know, essentially my husband's job became remote forever, and it didn't make sense to live where we were living anymore. So we lived there for a year. It was great, but we did come back to New Hampshire. So that was like the push that I needed to go just do it, because I, you know, was leaving my job, and I was going to be able to have all the time to kind of invest in, you know, building the things that I wanted to build. I did take a course that helped me kind of just narrow down my focus and what I needed to do from another dietitian entrepreneur, which I encourage people to do if you can afford it. It's really helpful, because you're basically paying for like a more direct way to do things, because you just don't know what you don't know when you're starting out. We're trained in dietetics. We're not trained in like social media marketing. Right.
making reels wasn't part of your dietetics training.
Like, I had no idea what I was doing. So, you know, I kind of had a bit more of a focus of like, okay, let me just make some small, like attainable goals and just go to work every day and make a schedule for myself and really put in, I put in a lot of time to buy my business. The first year I probably worked like 60 hours a week, you know, just trying to get everything underneath itself so that I had a website, you know, I had content all the time on social media. I was making, you know, my own handouts and educational resources for my clients that I was slowly getting through word of mouth and through social media. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, they were being successful. So that was helping kind of grow things. As you can tell, probably I'm pretty long-winded. So that's what made me want to start a podcast.
good at talking. We're going to say good at talking.
Yeah. I was like, I'm wasting people's time on like Instagram stories, talking about different topics. Like I should just start a podcast. So that's kind of what led me to do that. But yeah, it's really grown from there. So I think if someone's thinking about it, like, you know, maybe take a course or even do like some of the free resources that other entrepreneurs, people who are doing what you want to do, you know, do that, like take the course or learn from them in some ways and just start chipping away at it, because there's so much work to do. You're not possibly going to know everything you have to do and you're not going to get it all done, but time's going to pass anyway. So just start chipping away at it and see if you like it. Like, see if you like the unknown and kind of generating your own success, because some people don't like that. They like the structure of going to work every day,
right?
Getting the paycheck, and they're like, their anxiety is lessened because they're comfortable with that. And there is nothing wrong with that. But I knew that I just would want more.
Yeah.
And so I think it was the right fit for me at the time, at least, especially it's been going well.
Yeah. I love this phrase, generating your own success. Whether you like that or not. Like, I think that that's so, even with my own company right now, like we're about 10 or so people now. And like, it's about, now it's the place where figuring out how people helping people figure that out for themselves. So like, who do we need to help create the best structure for in their job? Right. Whereas who will thrive being entrepreneurial within their own, even within their own job. Right. So it's a question like I think about a lot. And I think it's really important what you just said too, to acknowledge like both, and like, it's okay if you like, it's okay no matter how you are and how much structure you need, but you need to figure out how to help yourself thrive in your job in that way too. Like, how many fail safes do I need? And if you don't want to take all the risks involved in creating your own business, then don't. Like, that's totally fine. Being a number two or a number three is a really great choice too, you know.
Totally. Like, I had actually accepted a job when we moved to North Carolina with another dietitian entrepreneur, and I was like, I think this is going to be great. Like, she worked in eating disorders and sports nutrition. I was like, oh my god, like what a great combo. And then And she offered me a very, very, you know, nice starting salary compared to what I was making. And it was so safe and so structured and it made all the sense, but I ended up turning it down. I was like, hey, look, I really like you. And I just can't picture myself not being an entrepreneur, and I don't want to leave you hanging. Like, I don't want to do that. So I was like, I think I'm going to go do this thing. And she like encouraged me and was super great about it, but it was wild. Like, that kind of showed me, cause I was going to accept it. It made perfect sense. But part of me was just like, oh, but like, you're going to not be happy. Like, you're still going to want to go do your own thing. So I think if that's you, like, you just got to go try it.
Yeah, totally. I had that experience the opposite way. Like, during the pandemic, like, we were working with someone who, like, you know, we had a great working relationship. I loved what she did and what she was about and the content she was creating. But I also was like, I just feel like she has this entrepreneurial buzz in her. Like, she needs to go do her own thing. Right. And so like, it's just like letting that go. As amazing as she was, I was like, we could build a great business together, but that's like, if someone needs to do that, they need to do that.
For sure. Totally.
I do have one last question for you from your a dietetics perspective, or even an exercise and dietetics perspective. Like, do you have strategies related to coping with stress? Like, I know like exercising, you know, broadly is a good way to cope with stress, but are there other things I could eat or things I could not eat?
Yeah, I think a couple things. So, and with a lot of the clients I work with, like, they're kind of similar where they're pretty motivated people. Like, you know, they figured out the whole exercise for stress relief thing. And actually sometimes we need to have other coping mechanisms too. Right.
So, yeah.
Cause it comes up, right? Like if you can't run, if you're injured, or, you know, if you have so many things going on in the day that you, for some reason, can't fit it in. So I think having, and I've learned this myself cause I am that way. But I think having other things to manage stress is super hard to figure out, but it's really helpful. So like, I know for myself, obviously I do my exercise. I think I have a much better relationship with it now from, it's not my only coping mechanism for stress like it mm-hmm. used to be, but I also like to read, you know, I like to kind of disconnect from social media if I can. I think we're not meant to have that constant, like, this is what people are presenting as their highlight of the day, going in the back of our brains. So I think even disconnecting from that. And for me, like, I follow a lot of people because I learn from them. And we don't need to learn all the time either. That's something I'm learning, is that, you know, it's okay to just kind of be and not need to like learn all the things all the time, because that's mm-hmm. really stressful. From a nutrition perspective, one, eating enough is going to essentially support the caveman part of your brain that gives us more anxiety when we're not eating enough. Not eating enough, you know, whether it's just acutely, like you're just starting to get hungry because it's been a few hours since you last ate, or chronically, you know, if our blood sugar is starting to get low, you know, that kind of signals that part of our brain to be like, uh-oh, you know, stress, go eat something. So eating enough in general can actually help us just be less stressed out. And again, I really push this with a lot of my clients, and it's really hard for people to hear, but if you are able to, please, please, please have water and food within an hour of waking up before you reach for caffeine. It will kind of allow your day to start on, you know, a more nourished level. You're going to be more hydrated. Your gut's going to be happy about that. And you're going to have food, which is what actually gives us energy, versus like a stimulant, which blunts our appetite, you know, but like makes our blood sugar crash and doesn't really give us energy. It only does like in the moment. Mm-hmm. So that's definitely a pattern that if it's like, people can try like one thing, and I know it's like really hard if you love your, and I love my cup of coffee in the morning, mm-hmm. but like, I gotta have water and food first. Otherwise, like I'm not going to be as good of a person later in the day, yeah. or be able to, I'll get overwhelmed more easily.
Yeah. What do you eat in the morning?
I personally, it kind of depends on if I'm running or not. If I'm going to run like earlier in the morning, I'll have something small before my run, like a gel or like a piece of toast or something like that. But my favorite like breakfast, if I have a while or if I'm not running, is I just really like oatmeal. It's like my thing. Mm. Like I like oats with like berries and peanut butter and flaxseed. And I really like iced coffee. That's like one of my favorite things too. But I like having that definitely with food, but that's probably my go-to breakfast.
Okay. I'm going to do it. I'm going to eat before, which means I'm going to be getting up straight to the water and snack and then yeah. have my coffee.
Yeah. Yeah. And like, it doesn't have to be like a huge meal, I tell people, but just having like something in your system before, you know, and some hydration if you can, before you're getting that, you know, mm-hmm. caffeine hit can be super helpful for people, especially if you do struggle to eat enough in general, or if you do have kind of like, if you're like a higher anxiety person, or if you find yourself crashing like later in the day, mm-hmm. it can be a helpful tip of patterns.
Yeah. Yeah. I definitely struggle to eat in the morning. You know, I think that's very common, and like not doing it is not helping.
You know, exactly. Like, well, then the coffee blunts your appetite and it makes it harder.
Right. Like, yeah, exactly. So I am going to try that. Thank you.
I love it. Tell okay, me how cool. it goes.
I will. So, okay. If people want to hear more of you talking, Holly, you have your own podcast. Where can they find that?
Yeah. If you just want to keep hearing my voice. I have a podcast. It's called the Fit Cookie Nutrition Podcast, and you can find it on pretty much any podcast player, like, you know, Apple, Spotify, Google, those types of things.
Cool. And then you have a program coming up, the Strong Runner Academy. Am I right?
Yeah. So my group coaching program is called the Strong Runner Academy. It's 12 weeks long, and we meet every single week, and we kind of build on our nutrition foundation as runners. I teach you kind of how to eat you know, in general, day to day to support your training and, you know, what a rest day versus like a higher intensity day versus a strength training day might look like. We talk about what to eat like before, during, and after your training sessions. We also talk about stress management strategies, body image, and kind of making sure you meet your micronutrient needs and from an injury prevention standpoint as well.
Well, that sounds amazing. Okay, cool. And where can people find you, just in general, website, or where can they watch your reels?
Yeah, you can watch my reels on, I'm on Instagram probably as my like main social media platform, typical millennial. But my handle is Fit Cookie Nutrition. And then my website is fitcookienutrition.com.
Cool. All right. Well, thank you, Holly, so much. This has been so fun. I'm sure my audience will love it, and hopefully talk to you soon.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
As we head into summer, rest and recovery are critical for improving sports performance, reducing stress, and living a long and healthy life. We should all invest in better sleep. So, think about the thing you lay your head on for 8 hours a night. If it's not exactly right for you, it can lead to needless tossing and turning, or worse, have you waking up with an unrelenting kink in your neck. My new Lagoon pillow has helped me improve my sleep immensely by pairing me with the performance pillow that has everything I need. So I personally was matched with the Otter pillow. Shout out to Team Otter, which I love because it has a gentle cooling effect. And I was able to choose how much stuffing I wanted in it, which is super important to me because I'm doing a decent amount of CrossFit these days and my shoulders are kind of creaky. So having a pillow that is stuffed just to the right height keeps my neck and head in exactly the right position and comfortable for the entire night. And as of fall 2023, Lagoon launched their 100% mulberry silk pillowcases. It's cool to the touch, buttery soft, and great for your skin and hair. You've got to go check out this pillowcase if you want to feel great and look great every morning. Waking up for morning workouts has never felt better. I'm refreshed and pain-free thanks to my Lagoon pillow. To check it out for yourself, go to lagoonsleep.com/performance and take the 2-minute sleep quiz to find your perfect pillow match. And then use the code PERFORMANCE for 15% off your first purchase. That's code PERFORMANCE at lagoonsleep.com/performance, whole 15% off, and the link is in the show notes. You can just click through there. Endurance sports should be accessible to everyone, right? That's why we are so excited to be partnering with Motive. Motive is one of the fastest growing training apps in the world today, with thousands of amateur athletes signing up every month and a nearly perfect 4.9 star rating in the App Store. You are not a template and your training plan should not be either. Prepare for running races, triathlons, cycling events, duathlons, or swim runs, however your season schedule shapes up, and get training written by some of the best coaches in the world in each discipline who know what it takes to help amateur athletes reach their goal on race day. The app takes the training written by those experts and then creates the most optimal training plan for your schedule, abilities, and goals. Plus, the training is fully customized to your race schedule. How much you can train each week, your current abilities, and the goals you want to achieve in your race. You can use the app for free as long as you want, or get all the upgraded features from the app for just $19.99 a month. But as a feisty listener, you can sign up at mymotive.com and use the code FEISTY for 2 months of full premium access. That's right, you get 2 months of premium for free. So you quite literally have nothing to lose. So head over to mymotive.com, mymotiv.com, and use the code FEISTY, FEISTY. And on a personal note, I know the founder of Motive, and he is driven to make triathlon and all endurance sports more accessible for the athletes who care about their performance, but who aren't quite ready for a full-time personal coach. If that sounds like you, definitely try the app for 2 months for free. You literally have nothing to lose.